tonight on Arena. Among the movies we'll review is Lin-Manuel Miranda's In the Heights, and Kush Kim Dance Company bring their choreography to handball alleys around the country. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena Thursday night. Of course, means film review night here on Arena, and what we might see in the cinemas if we venture out this weekend. We have four new films for your consideration. In the Heights is the screen version of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Tony Award-winning Broadway stage show. And the film is directed by Crazy Rich Asians' John M. Chu. The Reason I Jump is Jerry Rothwell's exploration of a group of young people with autism. In the Earth is a horror film from Ben Wheatley, and It Must Be Heaven, a very personal film from Palestinian Eli Suleiman. Roe McDermott, Justin McGregor have been watching all four, and they join me this evening. Let's start with In the Heights, from the pen of the man who created the stage and screen sensation that was Hamilton. However, In the Heights, I suppose, owes more to West Side Story than to the founding fathers of American narrative that was part of Hamilton. And this was the stage show that preceded the success of Hamilton. What's the basic setup here, if you would give it to me, Justin?
So the In the Heights are Washington Heights, which is the uppermost borough of Manhattan. And certainly from the 70s up until very recently was predominantly Latinx. So people from the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Cuba, and South America, Central America lived there and had a very, very tight knit family feeling. And this is Lin-Manuel Miranda's kind of homage back to that neighborhood. So we have some characters who Usnavi is our storyteller, who's taking on the role that Lin-Manuel Miranda played himself in the play. And he's telling the story of how he came to be where he is and telling the story of the Heights to four young children. And that's sort of the framing device that gets us into the musical numbers and the story.
And dreams very much at the heart of every character, well, certainly the main characters in this role.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you weren't well-versed in theatre history, you would absolutely be forgiven for thinking that this is almost a spiritual successor to Hamilton, because both are themed around immigrants, the power of a dream. But I think where Hamilton at this historical setting and a period vibe, In the Heights, like, wears its heart completely on its sleeve as this celebration of Latinx culture and this examination of family and faith and fate and the role of the American dream for a community that faces a huge amount of microaggressions, a huge amount of systemic oppression that comes into the film, I think, more so than the play. But it is this idea of everybody working incredibly hard, but building community in a country where they don't often feel welcome.
And I guess what we're dealing with is those who want to stay in the community don't want to leave it for various reasons, and those who want to get out as quick as they possibly can, and those who want to go back to the homeland, as it were, in this case the Dominican Republic. So there are lots of immigrant stories being explored across the various characters. We're led through the whole thing by Anthony Ramos. What a great name he has. I thought, oh, Usnavi. I was looking and listening to the name for ages. And then eventually we get told how he got his name, Justin.
Yeah, no, it's an absolutely wonderful story that when the family, they emigrate when Anthony Ramos's character is 8 years old, and they're coming on the boat and they see this U.S. Navy ship in the harbor, and they decide that's what we're going to, you know, that's what his name will be, Usnavi. So it's very, very funny. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's kind of, that's the kind of the level, the type of humor that we're getting, and a real warm, nostalgic feel within it as well. Let's have a listen to the aforementioned Anthony Ramos as Usnavi, and you'll hear the entire ensemble joining him eventually here as well.
Maybe you're right, sonny, calling the coroners. Maybe we're powerless, a corner full of foreigners. Maybe this neighborhood's changing forever. Maybe tonight is our last night together. However, how do you want to face it? Do you want to waste it when the end is so close you can taste it? Y'all could cry with your head in the sand. I'ma fly this flag that I got in my hand. Can we raise our voice tonight? Can we make a little noise tonight? Can we sing so loud and raucous they can hear us across the bridge and east of Caucasus?
A it's impossible not to jump up and down in the chair and smile as you're listening to that. The music here, Ro, is certainly in terms of the rap content very similar to Hamilton, but we have there's very much a Latinx and that's Puerto Rican feel to the music that we're getting.
Absolutely. Lin-Manuel Miranda obviously has his undeniably consistent style in terms of his cadence and his wordplay, but that also means that the quality is really consistent too, and the songs are so much fun. I think John Chu's direction translates this Broadway spectacle onto the screen with just so much fun, and there's the brightness and the warmth that is reminiscent of Crazy Rich Asian's vibrant palette, and it has this incredibly fun choreography that brings in so many different styles, playing with these huge, huge, big set pieces. If I will say, sometimes the camera angles and edits undermine the incredible dance sequences and make them slightly flatter than they could. But they're just such beautiful, magical sequences. There are two lovers step off this tenement fire escape and they pirouette up and down the walls of a building. There's a public swimming pool scene that turns into this Busby Berkeley kaleidoscope of colour. And there's a scene set in a beauty salon where the wigs start bouncing around and the acrylic nails start tapping, and it's just these huge production numbers that are so much fun. And I think genuinely in the era of COVID, I was just watching this going, oh my God, I want to be dancing in a crowd of people it's so joyous.
Yeah, you heard it even within that clip, you know, the big roar. There's hundreds of people on the street dancing as they're going along to that. In fact, it was like a version of Bollywood. It struck me, except with a different style of music, obviously, a different style of dance that was involved. However, for all that warmth and all that joy and all that laughter and there's lots of crying that you'll be doing in the midst of it as well, I would guess. Lin-Manuel Miranda, director John M. Chu, have been accused of relegating the Black Latinx community to the background and of having a central cast that could colour pass, meaning pass for white American. What was all that about, Justin?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda and John M. Chu have apologized for not having, you know, the Afro-Latinx community represented as much in the film. He's promised to do better, and to be fair, like, even the cast was like, they didn't notice at the time, is what you know, it's kind of what they say. But definitely there's an underrepresentation. I mean, if you've ever been to the Dominican Republic and Cuba, you know that there's this real diversity within those communities themselves, and definitely this is a bit more maybe of a dated vision of what that community looks like.
And, you know, we inevitably there'll be thoughts of West Side Story, why we don't have any kind of intercommunity strife at the heart of this. It's a very happy community that we get, Ro. Did it remind you in any way of West Side Story? Is it impossible not to think of West Side Story with the type of music that we get?
I think there is obvious parallels. I think something that has to be acknowledged is Lin-Manuel Miranda is such a talented writer, a talented actor, a talented performer. But I think at heart, he's a political romantic and a romantic optimist. And he's not a radical in any way. He's a crowd pleaser. He's not revolutionary. And I think there's something really warm about his work, that he believes in promise and the potential of pop culture. But it means he leans into kind of commercially packaged things and the supreme power of love and all these uplifting. But it means that the story occasionally dodges the more political bends to it. So there's a very tacked on, very underwhelming thread about DACA and dreamers. There's an underwhelming protest that, when compared to the choreographed dance scene, just feels a little bit underdeveloped. It's cotton candy. It's joyous. It's fun. It's not radical. And I think that might disappoint some people. But if you're going looking for a good time, it's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I suppose part of that kind of the pseudo or kind of political story within it is the character of Nina, played by Leslie Grace. She has spent some time in Stanford. She's one of the ones that the whole community wants to be successful in terms of college. But she's mistaken for waiting staff at one point along the way. And on another occasion, her room is searched when her white roommate thinks that she has been robbed. And of course, there's only one person could have done it, and that's the person from the Latinx community. It really, this isn't about any of that, though, I would guess, Justin. It is about having a good time singing and dancing.
No, it is. I mean, I think they're a nod towards that, you know, towards that reality. But no, this is a celebration of, there's a lot of nostalgia here and, you know, a desire for communal belonging. And really, it is more reminiscent of those Depression era Hollywood musicals like 42nd Street or Footlight Parade, which people went and watched and they could forget about the Great Depression. And I think definitely this film has leaned into making us forget about the pandemic more than addressing, you know, the many issues that that the community faces in the United States, certainly.
Absolutely. Fair enough. Well, let's see how it figures out. You do need a bit of time to watch it, however. Is it 2.5 hours or thereabouts? It's really a stage show put on screen. It hasn't been condensed down in any way. Stars from you, Justin?
You know, it's exactly what you know you'd expect. There's a nice updating going from these kind of intimate scenes to the big numbers, which I think is really, really nice. But I'd go very comfortable at 4.
Say that again, Jonathan, sorry. Or Justin?
4 stars for
4.
Me.
And what are you saying, Ro?
I think a little bit too long, some slightly dead spots in the middle. Again, some viewers might wish for sharper edged political exploration. But I have to say, it's two hours, 20 minutes. I spent a good hour of that a bit teary, both with joy and romance and just getting swept up in it. So a 4 for me.
4
from
you.
Absolutely delightful.
Totally manipulated the emotions for me as well, I have to say. Right, let's move on then to The Reason I Jump, documentary from Jerry Rothwell based on the book by Naoki Higashida. The author who gives an insight into his life as a non-speaking autistic person in the book of the same name, The Reason I Jump. We spoke with Jerry Rothwell on the programme last night, but it takes its name from the book, the film, but really it explores the lives of 6 young non-speaking autistic people. Hugely powerful in the way it tells this story, Ro.
Yeah, because I think one thing that really struck me while I was watching this film is I haven't seen a film that explores, or indeed a documentary of any type, that really explores autism amongst girls, amongst people of colour, and so many representations of autism and research into autism and expectations of autistic children are based around gender norms and often solely focused on young white men. But this transports us across 4 continents, and it highlights the specific experiences, perceptions, talents, natures, and the existences of several people living with autism. And so Rothwell travels across the globe. He takes us to India, where we meet an incredible artist, Amrit, to the USA, where there's a young man named Ben who learns to spell and express himself with the help of speech therapists. And he has this lifelong friendship with another autistic woman, Emma. We see a Broadstairs family whose son Josh becomes incredibly frustrated, but he's also really attracted to interesting sounds such as electricity. And then we go to Sierra Leone, where the parents of Justina are educating their Sierra Leone community about their beloved daughter, her condition, and this backdrop of misinformation and superstition. So we're really looking at diverse experiences.
And the whole thing is held together, those stories held together, Justin, then by this narration from Naoki Higashida's book in a translation by a co-translator, David Mitchell, who he and his wife have a son with autism, in fact, and we get their explanation of their involvement in the story. But the book seems to have been hugely powerful to the entire community involved in autism.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it even got translated in the first place was, as you mentioned, Naoki Higashida and her husband, David Mitchell, is a novelist. They speak Japanese. They'd read the book and it just opened their eyes to who their son was. And so they decided to translate it so that their carers would know who their son was. And of course, it became a New York Times bestseller. And some of the parents in the documentary acknowledged that, you know, reading the book just completely made them aware of this whole other side of their children that they had no idea existed. So really fascinating the way they use this kind of narration and cinematography to link the families and to link the experiences of the people that we're meeting.
And the narration is voiced by an autistic actor, Jordan O'Donovan, but I want to go to 2 of the young people whose stories are told in this, and that in fact they're adults at the point we meet them, Emma and Ben, who you mentioned, Ro. Emma and Ben are friends for a long time. They're doing schoolwork. Emma's mother is teaching them at home and she's using spelling boards with them.
They've never been able to do this before. I mean, this is the first time they've ever had any access to curriculum. Emma, what was education like before you had these classes to go to? T-H-E-Y-W-A-S-T-E-D-T-I-M-E. They wasted time.
Let's go
Okay, Ben, how do you feel? T-S. They've denied our civil rights.
I'm sorry, Mommy. Sorry, Mommy.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Scene there from The Reason I Jump, featuring Ben and Emma and Emma's mum teaching them and teaching, and then Ben teaching us all something. That for me, Ro, was one of the most profound moments in the film.
Yeah, I think it's so incredible the way this film just acts like such a bridge between non-speaking autistic children and their parents, between reductive misconceptions about autism and the infinite constellations of human experience that we get a glimpse of here. And drawing attention to those gaps is a huge part of what this film does. And I think the role of the parents in the film, as we said, is so important. But they still illustrate these gaps between the understanding between them, and the parents realize, and the audience's increasing realization that things like time are not experienced by autistic people and non-autistic people in the same way. And Joss has this incredible sequence where he's explaining his memory and how he has this almost photographic memory of when he was a child, and those memories are as vivid as his memories of yesterday. And it's this idea that they're not linear in the way that perhaps a neurotypical person's memory would be. And I think those gaps and those scenes are incredibly powerful in highlighting some of the gaps that we may not be aware of and pointing to the other gaps that we need to remain aware of.
And one of the great achievements for me, Justin, is this idea that, in fact, the film, and in fact we have to go back to Naoki Higashida and his book, it gives voice to these non-speaking people. That's precisely what it does.
Yeah, and it's amazing because I think they do it sort of on two levels. There's the actual written text that's being read to us that is, you know, it's profound and it's insightful and it's illuminating. And then they match it up with these amazing visuals. Like Naoki talks about, you know, when you look at a mountain, he might see a dandelion at his feet, but he sees like one speck of that dandelion, and how he has to kind of zoom out to even get to the mountain. Mm. And the camera does the same thing. The camera will go in to these moments that are being described and just give you like a glimpse of what that must be to see the world like that for a moment and piece together the larger picture from these infinitesimally small fragments. I mean, it's really a remarkable insight that they give you, whether you're neurotypical or have a child who's neurodiverse. It's absolutely astounding.
I want to listen to part of the narration, the words of Naoki Higashida in translation here, but spoken by the autistic actor Jordan O'Donoghue.
So, how do I see the world? You may be looking at the exact same thing as me, but how I perceive it appears to be different. When you see an object, it seems you see it as an entire thing first, and only afterwards do its details follow on. But for me, the details jump straight out first of all. And then gradually, detail by detail, the whole image floats up into focus.
Jordan O'Donoghue there with part of the narration from the film The Reason I Jump. Justin was mentioning that precise quality that Naoki Higashida gets across in his book, Ro, but also we get a sense of it in that clip. There's a wonderful soundscape in this film.
Yeah, really beautiful. And I think Jerry Rothwell, the director, pays such attention to individual stimuli. He pays attention to the hum of a radiator and the lights of screens and the texture of a metal piece of mesh And that those sensations and those stimuli receive the same kind of attention that most documentaries reserve for talking heads. So he's literally using the cinematic language to try accurately, or at least to attempt a summary or an approximation of the experience of being an autistic person, while Nanita Desai's score builds these beautiful little symphonies out of ambient noise to show the kind of sensory perception that these children and these autistic people are often dealing with. And I think it's that attention to the sensory details that also add an extra layer of understanding to the film.
I feel crass almost here asking about stars, but what are you saying, Ro?
I'm going to give it a 4. I think it's really beautiful. I think I'm so aware of my role as a neurotypical person that I don't think we get to be the final critics of this film. And I think the point of this film is not to be representative of the entire spectrum, but to illustrate some perspectives and to illustrate the gaps in our understanding and to open up a conversation. And I think this is a film about neurodivergent people for largely neurotypical audiences. I think the most important responses from the film will come from autistic people themselves, and I'll be listening. But I think for me, it opened up a huge range of thoughts and insights in my mind. So I'm going to give it a 4. Yeah.
Justin?
Oh, I just didn't see how you could improve this film, how it made you feel as a parent, how it made you feel about, you know, that world and getting a glimpse of it, and maybe your own lack of knowledge, you know, before you had this learning. I just didn't see how you could improve it, so I gave it 5 stars.
5 from you. All right, that's the reason I jump. And if you want to listen back to our interview with Jerry Rothwell, it was on last night's programme. You'll find it on the website, rte.ie/radio1/arena. Elias Suleiman writes, directs and stars in a deadpan comedy about a Palestinian filmmaker trying to make his next film. In a mostly silent performance, we meet him at home in Nazareth before he travels to Paris and New York in search of funding. I suppose Palestine and Palestinian issues and comedy are not often two things that we find in the same space at all, Justin.
No, and that's very much sort of his perspective in his previous two films as well, is that, you know, a Palestinian worldview isn't just this conflict, that there's so much more, obviously, the culture and the society, and that he wants to, you know, represent that, not as a rebuttal to the evening news, but as an enhancement, you know, to what you read in the papers and what you see going on there. But he's very much aware of that. I mean, he does in the film, he's trying to get funding for a film that may be the film you're watching, or maybe another film, you know, it's all very unclear. Yeah. And he meets a French producer who's really political, really wants to make a film about Palestine, but his film's not Palestinian enough, and it just leaves him sort of sitting there and being escorted out of the meeting, so it's a very unusual but brilliant rounding out of that worldview.
I was totally taken in, I have to admit, by the first, I suppose, it's maybe minute of the film. Ro, if you would describe what happens in the opening scene and then how it's totally undercut.
Yeah, so this must be having have this certain narrative linearity, but it's made up of small vignettes, and they frequently begin with kind of observational shot, then they cut to Suleiman watching the action play out and his reaction. But the opening is an exception that sees a bishop lead this very serious nighttime procession to the portal of a church, where the custodians then refuse to open the doors, and this shouting match ensues. It becomes all very tense as people are trying to get in the church, and multiple metaphors can be read into this scene, this idea of people refused entry to their communal space. But fundamentally, it's so funny to watch, and Suleiman just plays this fury of this procession and this churchman's fury before his flocks for absolute laughs. And it's those powers of observation and just twisting very serious seeming situations and finding the absurdity and the comedy in it, which is just so much fun. So immediately you're kind of put on your back foot and saying, oh, this is not what I expected.
No, because I mean, I kind of thought, if you can imagine the life of Brian being deadpan, that's, it's kind of, that's the area that we're in here, Justin.
Yeah, no, very much so. I mean, he started as a documentary filmmaker, and there's this wonderful, you know, we're observing something, and then it's like we see the camera, but we, you know, it's a camera that's alive, so it's reacting to what it's seeing. And there's this amazing back and forth between what he's observing and what's happening, and always this feeling maybe that things could go wrong. You know, yeah. There's also this feeling of threat. There are these two brothers drinking whiskey and they're upset that their sister has had fish with a wine sauce. And you never know if it's going to go really, really dark. And it always just manages to avoid that. But it's just so brilliantly realized, these little moments that sometimes there's no punchline. And it's just the moment itself is the joke that you're watching.
Exactly. There's another one where he's observing a neighbor who may or may not be robbing the lemon grove next door. He may be there with the neighbor's permission, but we don't quite know. And he seems to be able to do, and then he's just standing there watching it. But it does shift location, as I said, then off out of its Nazareth setting across to Paris and to New York. What dynamic does that bring to the film, Ro?
I think it's all about Suleiman's observations of the world around him and his reaction. And his comedic presence often evokes like Buster Keaton and Chaplin. He has this incredibly expressive face. Sometimes he's evoking Woody Allen and not in a great way. There's just an incredibly creepy montage where he's just ogling the legs of French women. But also there's a montage where he's ogling the feet of the Palestinian women. So what I took from that is that he's going to be a creepy old man everywhere. But I think what he examines is the idea of he looks at, you know, these incredible sequences of army tanks rolling past the Banque de France on Bastille Day, and then he's wandering around Williamsburg in this incredible sequence where everybody he sees at the supermarket casually carries a gun on their shoulder. And it's this idea of the perception of Palestine as this incredibly weaponized, militarized space, but also how those dynamics play out everywhere and kind of taking that Western view of Palestine and twisting it back on itself and saying, well, look at what's happening in your own country. But often in these really beautifully choreographed ways. There are several sequences with policemen on segways, but it's like a ballet taking place, even though the presence of police, it again indicates that something is going wrong. So there's a sense of menace and absurdity and beauty that's always just playing together really well.
I'm not sure whether it was Ro who just said there about the expressive face ever. In fact, it was yourself, Justin, but Suleiman has the most expressive face ever, but he doesn't move a muscle in any of those expressions. It's absolutely deadpan.
No, I'd love to see it on an IMAX to see if there's traceable reactions on his face, because it just comes back to this person, you know, absorbing and taking it in, and it's a great twist because then it puts the burden of reaction on the audience of projecting what we realize is going on and understanding what's happening. But as Rose said, like they're almost dance numbers, you know, with the police and the way people are moving. And, you know, there's a scene in the car with sunglasses, two police officers sharing each other's sunglasses, and the choreography is hilarious. And then it pans to the back seat and there's a blindfolded Palestinian woman in cuffs. And you just, it's so absurd. It's so brilliantly absurd.
And you can make great political points in the most absurdist fashion. And maybe that's what's going on here as well. Stars from you then first this time, Justin?
Well, sit back, enjoy, expect nothing. And if you do, I think you'll agree with me that it's at 4.5, maybe a 5, 4.5.
Yeah, nothing happens 4.5 to 5 times in this film for sure. And what are you saying, Ro?
I'm going to say it took me about 20 minutes to just accept that there was not going to be dialogue, that it was going to be a lot of observation in this man's face. And then I think the more I thought about it, the more I enjoyed the humour of it. So I'm going to give it a 4. As Justin said, keep expectations and absolute nothing and just enjoy the absurdity and the beauty and the weirdness.
Absolutely. Okay. It Must Be Heaven is the title of the film. Let's move on then to our final film this evening, In the Earth, folk horror story set in the time of pandemic deep in the English forest. Dr. Olivia Wendell, played by Hayley Squires, has gone missing. Film written and directed by Ben Whateley, and it stars, among others, Reese Shearsmith, who you may have heard in the programme last week. Kill List and A Field in England. What would you expect from Ben Whateley, and does this fit into that category, Justin?
Yes, I mean he went off a little bit and made a film called High Rise and the remake of Rebecca that I think most people would prefer, including himself, to forget. And he's definitely come back. He's definitely come back to, instead of A Field in England, this is A Forest in England. So he's definitely come back to his genre. horror. The horror is the wrong word. Of kind of dread. There's a kind of grimness to this world. There's definitely body horror. People constantly getting cut and nicked, yeah. or as they say, catching themselves on things. So there's a lot of like little bits of blood and, you know, a feeling of a very, very grim world set in a pandemic, whether it's this one we're in or a different one. Who never knows? Fully explained.
Yeah. Does it work overall in terms of that horror? Because it is very hard to pin down. I referred to it as a horror film on several occasions, certainly talking to Reese Shearsmith. He seemed to accept the term horror. Does it fit into a category here, Ro, for you?
I think it meanders from plague movie to folktale to horror to science fiction. And I think what's an interesting parallel is to look at Alora Tokia, who plays Alma in the film. She also was in Ari Aster's Midsommar, which is this Ari Aster's visually sumptuous horror film about also a nature-focused pagan cult, but it had toxic masculinity, post-traumatic stress disorder, and the ethics of anthropological academia, as you do. And I think that's an interesting comparison because that is a film that weaves together all these different yeah. threads of kind of cultness, of folktales, of horror, of kind of social dynamics. Wheatley isn't as interested as trying to unite his threads in the way that Aster does. And instead, he's relying, as Justin said, on dread and atmosphere, relies on this very moody synth score from Clint Mansell as this glue that warps along in a vein right. reminiscent of John Carpenter. It's very much about the atmosphere rather than the plot coming together. And Ben Wheatley seems very happy to have a climactic freak out at the end.
Does atmosphere get stars from you?
This didn't entirely work for me. I think he was filming it during COVID. I think there's some really interesting things going on. I think some of the actors are playing with more campy elements and playing into the humour and some aren't. And so to me, it really didn't cohese as much as I'd like. I think it's interesting. I think given the year and its themes, it will bring a chill to some people. But for me, it was a three.
A three? Yeah, is that what you said? Yeah, and what are you saying, Justin, overall?
Yeah, no, it's got this feeling of like BBC 1970s sci-fi slash not even as good as Doctor Who in it that I thought didn't quite work. Look, I think a Wheatley fan will say 4.5, or her fan will say 3.5, but really it's a 2, let's be honest.
Okay, fair enough. That is Ro McDermott and Justin McGregor on our four films this evening, In the Heights and In the Earth, which will be on general release, both of those. The Reason I Jump will open at the IFI tomorrow, and It Must Be Heaven will also be at the IFI and available on IFI at Home.